From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're getting a reaction to two big decisions from the Supreme Court today. In Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin, the justices ruled that the university can consider race as a factor in admissions. And in the United States versus Texas, the justices deadlocked 4-4 on President Obama's executive action that would have shielded millions of undocumented immigrants from deportation.
And that tie leaves in place the lower district court ruling blocking the president's plan. President Obama spoke a short time later.
I think it is heartbreaking for the millions of immigrants who made their lives here, who raised families here, who hoped for the opportunity to work, pay taxes, serve in our military, and more fully contribute to this country we all love in an open way.
Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, tell us, first of all, what is the president's plan that's now been blocked?
You remember the Dreamers plan from a few years ago, allowing people who had been brought to this country as children to obtain legal status and stay in the country and move forward. And this was extending this to a wider circle of family members and people who are in this country illegally, but who have family members who are here legally and who have been living, as the president says, in the shadows. It doesn't give them permanent status, but it defers any action on their cases until further legislation may come along to rationalize our current immigration legal picture.
There's also protections for parents of the children who are in the country legally. So just as people are reacting to this, we'll talk more about the case, but what does that mean? Does that mean that all those people are deported?
It means that they are subject to deportation, and it means that they continue to have the anxiety of that situation and status going forward for an indefinite period of time. That's what the president was saying he found regrettable. It's why he acted when the House of Representatives refused to act on the immigration reform that had been passed by the Senate, also just a few years ago. That was in 2013, and the House just did not take up the bill at all and has not taken up any kind of a comprehensive immigration plan. So the president, in frustration, issued these executive orders in the manner that I've described. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of political background of it. It was challenged in court. A federal judge down in Texas put it all on hold. He was upheld by a circuit court of appeal in New Orleans that handles the Texas cases. And then it went to the Supreme Court more or less on a kind of expedited basis. But it has not been decided. Let us make it very clear. What this court's tie at 4-4 has done is it has said that nothing can change until another Supreme Court justice can be added and a more definitive precedent-setting decision can be made by that new court.
Huh. In the meantime, we're reading that Congress hasn't provided enough money to deal with, you know, deporting the many people who are in the country undocumented, and that the president still has a lot of discretion to decide who gets deported. But Paul Ryan, House Speaker, is saying that the case means that the Constitution was vindicated, that the president can't write laws, only Congress can. Is that a fair interpretation?
That is not what the Supreme Court decided today. That is what the lower courts were indicating with their rulings, and the lower courts prevail until the Supreme Court can make up its mind. So there are two ways to look at this. Yes, Paul Ryan is right that the lower courts were siding with the view of Congress that the president was exceeding his authority under the Constitution with these executive orders, but that has not been determined yet in a final fashion. That can only be done by the Supreme Court, and it will have to be done when there are 9 justices, and we expect that to be next year, and we expect this case to be back and back soon.
Right. Well, the court also ruled on Fisher v. University of Texas, as we said. This was a challenge to UT's affirmative action program. They said the university can legally consider race in their admissions process. Give us a little history here.
Well, Texas has a system what they call the top 10% system, where the top 10% of the graduates of every high school in the state are eligible for the University of Texas. And as a result, they get a certain amount of diversity just from the diversity of the various high schools around the state. But they have an additional program of affirmative action in which they can take race into consideration in admitting students beyond that 10% plan. And that has been the focus of the controversy. And Judge Alito, Samuel Alito, today wrote a 50-page dissent from the decision, saying that he felt that that disadvantaged young people who maybe came from an impoverished background but were not members of a racial minority.
You know, while we have you, Ron, there's been other things going on as well, including Democrats having an overnight sit-in. They've decided to end the sit-in. One of the organizers, Representative Catherine Clark, says they will be back after July 4th. There's a break now, and they will come back with their demand to have a bill, some kind of a bill, on gun control. Your thoughts on what has happened overnight?
This is really an unusual situation, if not perhaps a historic one, an unprecedented one. House Democrats, in their frustration, have decided that if the House Republican leadership will not schedule any kind of a vote on a gun bill, either the measures that were voted on in the Senate or some other gun control measure, that they're just going to sit down and demand it. So they spent the night, many of them literally sleeping on the carpet in the well of the House chamber, and they're pledging to come back on the day after the 4th of July and renew this protest, despite the fact that the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, has declared it to be a violation of the rules and will not let the House come back into session so long as they continue to carry on this demonstration. Paul Ryan calls it a publicity stunt. And, of course, if you've been watching, and it has been possible through the offices of Periscope to see some of this, even on C-SPAN and elsewhere in social media, the speeches that are being made by many of these members recall much of the spirit of the civil rights movement and the idea of peaceful protest and confrontation, if you will, but basically a mass resistance and, if you will, civil disobedience even to the rules of the House, of which these members are sworn members. So yeah. It is an unusual situation.
Yeah. Well, it reminds us that one time Representative Pete Stark actually called the police on Republicans. So we'll take a look at the history at another time. Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And let's get to the big vote going on in the United Kingdom today on the question of whether the UK should stay in the European Union or not. The polls have been very close, and NPR international correspondent Peter Kenyon is in London with the latest. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Jeremy.
So how's the turnout so far?
Well, the rules here are pretty strict in certain ways. Broadcasters, they're not allowed to talk about opinion polls. They can't report on what the campaigns are saying. And that also applies to turnout. We're not going to get the turnout figures until the polls close in a few hours. Also, I should mention, unlike in an American vote, there's not going to be any exit polls. So we have to wait for ballots to be hand counted, delivered to a central point, and then results announced. I can tell you on the turnout question, I've been to a couple polling stations. There were no lines stretching around the block, anything like that. Although here in London, voting does tend to happen on the later side.
And to be clear, you are allowed to tell us what's going on as an American reporter for an American audience today, which is why you were able to give us that tidbit there about the lines. But you've been out talking to voters. What are people saying?
Well, it's an interesting mix of views. One man, Peter Hudson, is one of the Leave voters, wants to pull out of the EU. He used to own a taxi company. He wasn't really eager to talk about the big hot button issue, immigration. He says for him, it's more about self-rule, accountability. Well, here's how he put it.
But ultimately, I think every country has the right to self-rule, to make their own laws, their own legislation, and not to have influence from outside and dictated to in those terms by a separate body that is not elected by the people of that country.
So that's on the one hand. But I also, of course, ran into a number of voters who want to stay in the EU. That's a fairly strong point of view here in London, mainly because of the economic benefits or just uncertainty about what might happen to the economy in the case of an exit. There are also some who are happy to have the protections that come with EU regulations. Over in East London today, I met Natasha Aiken. She was pushing her 3-year-old daughter, who sadly has the chicken pox. Well, Aiken did have time to vote to remain in the EU. And she says she's pretty disturbed by the harsh tone of this campaign. Here's what she told me.
I found it very scary. I find that publicity and the rhetoric very aggressive, especially the Leave campaign, of course, with its sort of xenophobic. It's not even undertone, really, is it? It's quite obvious. It's very xenophobic. And I find that disturbing.
So some different views there on the Brexit vote that's going on today. And Peter, we hear it's raining in parts of England.
Yes, welcome to a British summer.
Well, what has that done? Do we know how that might affect the vote?
Well, we won't get the figures until after the polls close, as I mentioned. But the bad weather, even some flooding in local areas, has been mainly in southeast England. That does include London, which is a key area for the Remain camp. So those turnout numbers will be watched with a good deal of interest. I have been asking people, just anecdotally, what do they think? And the answer is about what you'd expect. Hey, this is Britain. We're used to a little water. It's not going to be that big a deal. But we'll find out in a few hours' time.
And we will be watching for that. We're going to get the results very late tonight, right, Peter? Around 10 p.m. the polls close in Britain?
Yes, that's when the polls close, but it'll be many hours after that before we get the results. There's hand counting to be done, centralized collection points, sometimes by boat or helicopter, you know, from these various islands. And then eventually we'll hear probably in the early hours of the morning, our time.
That's Peter Kenyon, NPR's international correspondent, on a very big day, a historic day in the United Kingdom as people there vote on whether to stay or leave the European Union. Peter, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
There's little doubt that the internet is one of the most powerful tools in the terrorist arsenal. ISIS has used social media to recruit fighters and inspire lone wolf attacks. So what to do about it? Well, we've got two opinions. Start with Neil Johnson, a physicist at the University of Miami. He led a team of scientists that created a mathematical model, not to find the single terrorist or the needle in the haystack, but to find patterns that might predict attacks. He joins us now by Skype. But Professor Johnson, this is interesting. We know police in Chicago are using an algorithm to try to find young people who might be perpetrators of or victims of violence before it happens. This is a trend of sorts.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. There are plenty of great programs trying to look at individuals or maybe particular target groups. But what we found is instead of worrying about that whole haystack and instead of having to worry about that one needle that you think might become important in the future, what we found is actually the data told us that these needles, if you like to use the analogy, they group together. They group together in a very specific way on the internet. And they do it in a way that, I mean, it changes over time. They adapt. It's very much, it's like an ecology. And that's what we found. And so it shifts the focus from individuals or from target groups over to the dynamics of these groups.
Well, this is fascinating. You say the tracking of terrorists is, as you say, there's an ecology. So we should take our cues from nature, the way, for instance, birds flock. And we have spoken to researchers before who have, for instance, looked at how, you know, birds flock and form patterns to study bicyclists in Vietnam. You know, that everything seems to go in this kind of, well, you explain it, this organic wave.
Yeah, I mean, precisely. I mean, birds don't talk to each other and say, well, OK, you go to the left, I'll go to the right, and then somebody else will fill in the middle. It's a self-organized pattern. And that's exactly what we found emerging. And the good thing is that there's an awful lot that we already know about such self-organized systems. And in fact, all we did was adapt some mathematics that was already known to reproduce exactly the patterns of pro-ISIS groups, these groups as they change over time, that we found on the internet.
Well, but, okay, a couple questions. I understand the birds flocking. If you've ever watched them, it is extraordinary. But on the internet, you can't see each other. So how do they have the same organic feel?
Yeah, it's exactly right, of course, the internet, it's a virtual world. But what they do is they tend to flock around themes, and they tend to flock around identities. These groups that we find online, some may be exchanging information about drones. In another group, they may be focusing on particular places in Eastern Europe where they're thinking that security may be weak. And so what you see is, it's in some sense, it's the equivalent of that, but it's in a very specific way. And with one very big difference, these groups online have predators. There are anti-ISIS, I mean, there are hackers, there are groups, there are agencies that are after them. And so what happens is every so often they completely fragment and they scatter and they then reform in different places. And it's that dynamic of the reforming and the building up, first of all, which we managed to describe mathematically, but second, which we can then use to understand ideas related to things like, for example, the so-called lone wolf.
Well, and you say that what we've learned is that the so-called lone wolf, the self-starting terrorist sympathizer, doesn't remain a lone wolf for long. He joins one of these small groups. You studied about 200 small groups, 100,000 members combined. But they had been lone wolves.
Yeah, so anyone who is observed, imagine just taking a snapshot of, we're going back to our analogy of the fish, take a snapshot, you see one fish. Yeah, but that fish at some stage in the past was part of a group. If you leave it long enough, you track it long enough, it will become part of another group, maybe even momentarily, but it will become part of a group. In the context of the pro-ISIS groups that we studied, this is very important, because if we could track then the equivalent of that so-called lone wolf, which group they've been in, we would know which specific material that they were exposed to. Was it the beheadings material? Was it this discussion of security in airports? We would have a better sense of maybe where that individual was heading.
I can hear someone saying, well, wait a second, why are you studying these people? Why don't you let someone know where they are and stop them?
You know, this is a very, and you hit it very well yourself. You know, suddenly we're talking about birds and fish, and, you know, then we're talking about pro-ISIS support. It doesn't sound very conventional. This type of science, which is very, you know, I stand by this science, but it's kind of new for this field. And like any new thing, I think it will take a while to get adopted. I hope not too long.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, our experience, I think experience of many scientists when trying to deal with policy, is not necessarily that that is such an easy task.
Neil Johnson, a physicist at the University of Miami, who's led a team of researchers that created a mathematical model to try to understand terrorists and their sympathizers online. Neil, Professor, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And so it sounds like Professor Johnson is trying to get someone to listen to his work on patterns of terrorist interaction. But let's turn to a researcher who's looking for the needle in the haystack. Hani Farid is a professor of computer science at Dartmouth College, a senior advisor to the Counter-Extremism Project. That's a nonpartisan policy group. And Professor Farid backs a new technology that's meant to make it easier for internet companies to instantly find and remove specific pictures and videos used as terrorist propaganda. But will those technology companies want to? He joins us from New York. Professor Farid, welcome.
Good to be here.
And first of all, what exactly are you doing or hoping to do?
Yeah, so what we're hoping to do and what we've done actually is develop technology that can extract from an image, a video, or an audio recording a distinct signature. And that signature allows us to automatically and efficiently and accurately remove any content that is deemed inappropriate. So that is, once a technology company says this video of a beheading or a call to violence is inappropriate and does not belong on our network, we extract the signature from that video or audio, and we now say anytime something gets uploaded, it gets compared against that, and if it's the same thing, then it gets removed. And essentially what we're doing is removing the whack-a-mole game that we play with this type of content. It appears, it stays up for a while, it comes down, and it pops up again, and we now have technology that allows us to eliminate it forever on the companies that participate in this program.
So that answers one of the questions people might have, which is free speech. Right now, Google and other companies already are eliminating content that they feel is inappropriate. So it's not as if you're going in there as the policeman and saying this is inappropriate. It's the companies that are.
That's exactly right. We are saying the companies have the right under terms of service to expunge any material that they deem unfit for their network. We are saying you don't have to do that manually anymore, or you have to do it manually once, and then we can come in and do that automatically for you.
Government officials in the U.S., we understand, see potential, but companies like Google and Twitter are expressing some questions about maybe a slippery slope. What if there's an ISIS flag and a news organization or a security firm might be using it for non-propaganda but maybe instructive reasons, and suddenly, boop, your technology removes it?
That's right, and that's the right question to ask. So what we are talking about is, in fact, only starting with what we call the worst of the worst. These are clearly extremely violent, clear violations of the terms of service for these various social media sites. Now, as you start to approach the line that you just described, you are going to have some very difficult and important discussions about what is and what is not appropriate content for your network. We are agnostic. The technology is agnostic. I do think that those questions are important to have, however, and I think you need to have all the players at the table to have those conversations. But when we deployed a similar technology in the child exploitation space, we had these very similar conversations of, well, what if it's somebody who looks like they're underage, and, you know, what if it's maybe not exactly sexually explicit, but it's close to being sexually explicit. And what we said is we are going to stay very clear from that line. We are going to remove content that is clearly 100% everybody agrees child pornography. And that way you stay away from those sort of dangerous lines that you don't want to get too close to.
And by the way, how long have you been doing that, removing child pornography?
Right. So back in 2008, I worked with Microsoft and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to develop a similar technology to what we are talking about today in the child exploitation space that is now being used worldwide. And we are now developing new technologies to handle video and audio as well as images. And so there is a precedent for this type of technology already working on these sites.
Yeah. Well, and one can see how, you know, get that stuff off. It's horrendous. But also, it's a way to find children. I'm thinking in that case. So, you know, I guess the question applies to any kind of removal of information. Isn't it removing something that, as horrendous as it is, could be in some way informative?
I think you're right. When we deployed this technology in the child exploitation space, we were told by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children that just gathering the statistics, just getting real data on where these images are coming from, how are they being distributed, what is the source, who is producing this, is incredibly informative. So I've heard the argument that when you take it down, you make it more difficult for law enforcement. I don't think that's true, because when we take it down, we actually have information. Who posted it? When? Where did it come from? Where is it being rebroadcast?
And
so there's
that,
a huge
yeah.
amount of information that we still have. We don't throw away that information.
Yeah. Well, and now you're applying that thinking to terrorism online. Hani Farid, professor of computer science at Dartmouth College and senior advisor to the nonpartisan Counter-Extremism Project. Professor Farid, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Sunday, a Chinese container ship will be the first commercial vessel to pass through the newly expanded Panama Canal. The project costs more than $5 billion. It more than doubles the canal's capacity so that new supersize container ships can move between Asia and the east coast of the United States. But one of the biggest ports along the east coast of the U.S., the port of New York, New Jersey, is not going to be ready to take those ships right now. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us with more. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, let's talk about the Panama Canal first. The expanded canal took nearly a decade to complete, 2 years longer than planned. Why would this canal be built and then the port along the East Coast, one of the biggest ports in the country, be unable to take these ships?
Well, it is truly shocking that there would be delays on a major construction project in New York. I mean, we're still waiting on, I think it's been like a century for them to finish a subway line.
The Second Avenue subway line, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, and, you know, not to knock on the MTA here, but we're talking about this being a really important thing to the Asian exporters and shipping lines that had pushed to make the canal wider. They needed it wider so they could accommodate larger ships that would be going through the canal, and they needed the Bayonne Bridge. This is an 83-year-old arch. It spans the channel between Bayonne, New Jersey, and New York, Staten Island, and that had to go up. I actually just traveled through there on a cruise ship once, and I could tell that it was a pretty tight fit for even for the cruise ship going through there. So in 2013, the U.S. Coast Guard approved a $1.3 billion bridge-raising project, but late last year, they announced that it's going to be delayed until the end of 2017. The reason? Miscalculations by the engineers.
So the big winner then is the port of Charleston in South Carolina, right, which is able to handle these ships.
Right, exactly. So, and good news for Charleston, good news for South Carolina. And the reason why is that, I mean, we're talking about an area that it's going to be servicing an area that had been really hard hit in really recent decades. There's an area called Upstate, and this was a textile hub for a century, and that's before the industry really began its decline in the 1970s. Well, ships that go into the port of Charleston, it's going to be the deepest on the east, the deepest harbor on the east coast. They'll then make all that cargo make its way by rail to this area called Upstate, which is sort of known as the inland port. It's about 200 miles inland, and from there, that those goods can be distributed up the east coast. Especially since there's going to be a delay on those ships
right.
being able to come up north. And, you know, there's a lot of companies are building warehouses and distribution centers there. For example, Rite Aid, they're building a 900,000 square foot distribution center there. And that's the first of three warehouses that they've got planned. And it means major jobs for this area.
Do we really need, though, these canals to be able to handle these bigger ships right now at a time when it seems like, in general, shipping is cooling off, Chinese economy cooling off a little bit? Can't we handle with the ships we have in the few seconds we have?
Well, we're still importing massive amounts of goods from China. And what this really does is it makes it so much cheaper for them to get goods to the East Coast if they're able to get them here as planned. I mean, it really is going to more than double the cargo capacity of the canal. And Now you can have ships that are large enough to carry up to 14,000 containers compared with around 5,000.
That's Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today, a judge acquitted Officer Cesar Goodson Jr. of all charges in connection with the death of Freddie Gray, the 25-year-old black man who died from injuries sustained while in police custody. Goodson drove the police van that took Gray from the Baltimore corner where he was arrested to jail. Prosecutors said Goodson didn't buckle him in and gave him a rough ride, resulting in the broken neck that killed him. NPR national correspondent Jennifer Ludden is in Baltimore. And Jennifer, Goodson was facing the most serious charges of the six police charged in this case. We just heard what the prosecutor said in wanting to convict him. What did the judge say today in acquitting him?
Well, the judge basically said that the state failed to prove its case. It just did not have the evidence. Judge Barry Williams said, there was a key part where prosecutors said Goodson took a right turn, kind of went by a stop sign and veered into the left, the other lane. Judge Williams said, I watched that video 15 times trying to see, did he really run it? And he's like, I just don't see it. I don't see that he did. He says there also was no evidence that Goodson could have, should have known the kind of medical distress that Freddie Gray was in. He says, look, this is not like an automobile accident. This was an internal injury. And he was facing away from officers every time they checked on him. A reasonable officer may not have realized Gray was in such distress. And also when it comes to seat belting detainees, he pointed out that regulations provide wide discretion for officers. And Gray had been combative earlier during his arrest in that video that went viral that so many people saw. And so really on count after count, Judge Williams said the state just failed to prove its case.
Well, Goodson was the third officer to go to trial. What's still ahead?
Right. So no conviction yet. And a lot of legal analysts I've spoken to say they kind of doubt that convictions are likely on the other trials that are now scheduled to take place over the summer. I mean, you never know. You can't rule it out. But both with Edward Nero, who was among one of a couple officers charged during the arrest of Freddie Gray, he was acquitted last month. And then another officer, Edward Porter, his trial ended in a hung jury late last year. And so now he and Goodson being acquitted. Those are the officers involved with the transport of Gray. And so a lot of legal analysts just don't see where you're going to get any convictions in this case at all.
We remind people Freddie Gray was arrested on April 12th for running from an officer who was on a bike patrol. A neighbor captured the arrest on video, him seeming to collapse and be dragged to the van. He did, though, arrive at the police station 45 minutes later and was already unresponsive. Did this come up in the trial of Goodson at all? I mean, there were questions, at least reported questions, about why it took so long.
Well, the trial went into great detail about what happened at each one of those stops, so there weren't really questions in the end. You know, there was the only police wagon on duty that day. There were supposed to be two. They had to respond to every call and so forth. So that wasn't the question so much as what exactly happened inside the van. And the judge said, I have been presented with a number of equally plausible options. The prosecution contends that his neck injury happened early in the ride, and therefore Officer Goodson and the others should have known he was hurt and should have known to call a medic and should have then seatbelted him. The defense says, no, we don't think the injury happened until the end, but really, we still do not know. And the judge said, presented with this, we don't have the evidence that the officers should have known he was in imminent danger of dying.
Jennifer Ludden, national correspondent for NPR. On the news that Judge Williams, the judge in the trial of Officer Cesar Goodson Jr., has acquitted Goodson of all charges in connection with the death of Freddie Gray. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, today's Supreme Court ruling shelving President Obama's plan to shield millions of undocumented people from deportation, including children brought here illegally, would not have affected the estimated 10,000 Central American children who came to the U.S. in 2014. They were too late for the president's proposal, even if it was upheld. And federal immigration records show that half of the unaccompanied children still don't have legal representation. A lawsuit moving through the courts in Washington state aims to change that. Jude Jaffe Block from the Fronteras desk at KJZZ reports.
A new client is arriving at the Office of Public Counsel, a Los Angeles legal service organization, for the very first time. The client is a 14-year-old girl from Guatemala who only speaks Spanish. She allowed us to sit in as long as we don't use her name. She wears Converse sneakers with her school uniform. Her dark hair is piled in a top knot. And occasionally, she flashes a shy smile. She's here because she's one of the more than 60,000 unaccompanied children put in deportation proceedings after being caught at the U.S.-Mexico border in the last 2 years. And up until now, she was on track to be among the 40% of those kids who never find a lawyer to represent them.
¿Sabes qué es el procedimiento de inmigración?
The legal assistant asks the young girl, who's in middle school, if she knows the immigration court process. She nods.
El procedimiento es que nos tenemos que presentar a corte y no fallar.
The procedure is we have to show up to court. We can't miss it. And come with a lawyer to explain why we left our countries.
She says a relative in Guatemala was abusing her, so her family hired a smuggler so she could join her mother in L.A. She could be eligible for asylum or a special legal status for foreign children who were abused or abandoned. But winning those cases is complex. After she showed up in court 3 times without a lawyer, the immigration judge told her she had to find one to come to her next hearing in the fall.
He said it's September. I have to come to court with a lawyer. Otherwise, my mom will have to represent me.
But her mother, who works as a nanny, doesn't know immigration law or speak much English, and she couldn't afford to pay the thousands of dollars lawyers charge for these cases.
Nerviosa y asustada.
I felt nervous and scared because we hadn't found anyone who would help us.
Other free legal service providers were booked, but finally, after months of waiting, she made it off a long wait list to be represented by public counsel at no cost. It's one of the legal service organizations getting federal funds to do this work. Bobby Gregg of the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement says there's a federal statute that requires her agency
to provide legal services for unaccompanied children to the extent practicable.
In the past, that meant giving children an orientation on their legal rights and putting some in touch with volunteer lawyers. But 2 years ago, when the number of child migrants surged, the agency began a pilot program to pay lawyers to represent a small portion of the kids. This year, the agency has a $54 million budget for all legal services for children.
We expect that with the funding we have available in this year, that we will be able to serve more unaccompanied children through direct representation than we were able to do in the pilot project, but unfortunately we cannot serve all of them.
8,000 kids will get free lawyers through the program this year. A few thousand more will be helped by other government initiatives. But more than 32,000 Central American kids have arrived in the U.S. since October. Judy London of Public Counsel, where the Guatemalan teenager is getting help, says it's still a lottery. Which kids get lawyers at no cost and which don't.
The problem is that every child deserves to have a fair immigration court proceeding, and that cannot happen without a lawyer.
Many of these cases are time-sensitive, since the window for some legal arguments, like child abandonment, can expire when a child turns 18. Immigration court data show the majority of kids without lawyers wind up skipping court and are ordered deported.
Until every child is guaranteed legal representation, there will not be fairness, and essentially children will remain at extreme risk.
In fact, that's the argument a federal lawsuit in Seattle is making. Stephen Kang of the American Civil Liberties Union is suing the federal government on behalf of child migrants.
The core claim in our case is that you cannot, consistent with the Constitution, put children in immigration court where they have to face off against trained government prosecutors without also providing the children lawyers of their own.
The government has argued there's no legal obligation to provide these children lawyers at taxpayer expense. But a judge recently denied the government's efforts to dismiss the case, and a trial is set for September. For Here and Now, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
And Jude's story comes to us from the Fronteras Desk, a public radio collaboration that focuses on the border, immigration, and changing demographics. And tomorrow, we'll look at why so many migrant children wind up in the hands of labor traffickers.
This week's news that Donald Trump has fired his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, has put three other Trumps into the spotlight. His three oldest children, Donald Jr., Eric, and Ivanka, who reportedly played a role in that decision. So who are Trump's children and how much influence do they have? Michael D'Antonio is the author of The Truth About Trump. He joins us. And Michael, the ones we hear most about are the three oldest that I just mentioned, but he has two others, right?
Right. He has a daughter named Tiffany, who's a student at the University of Penn, and a son named Barron, who's still in grade school.
So how influential are Donald Trump's kids?
Oh, I would say that they form the real kitchen cabinet, to borrow a term from the Reagan years. They are the ones he turns to for advice that considers what's best for Donald, but also what's best for the Trump organization going forward. So they have in mind, I think, preserving the company, but also protecting their father.
One more than the other, or all three of them equally?
Oh, I think Ivanka is kind of the leading voice when it comes to politics and public relations, especially. Donald Jr. is probably the one that he might rely on most for advice about real estate.
And what is Ivanka's background? What more do we know about her?
Well, you know, she's a very polished person who's well-educated. I think she moves in circles that Donald doesn't understand. You know, she's a millennial. She's just a more likely to understand how people who aren't Trump insiders might view her father.
And what about Eric Trump? What's his background?
Eric's the youngest. He was a real small kid, 5 or 6, when the big sex scandal happened in the early 90s that really marked these kids pretty much for life. For his part, Eric was probably least aware of all of that, and I see him as the one who's most devoted to the father's image. You know, the other two can see him in a almost ironic way, but Eric is pretty devoted. You know, he even said to me that he thought his father was a lot like Winston Churchill or Teddy Roosevelt. You know, this was a couple of years ago when the guy wasn't even a candidate for office.
And you say that Donald Jr. is somebody that Donald Trump Sr. would go to for thoughts about real estate. What is Donald Jr.'s background, or what does he bring to the campaign?
You know, I think he's very hard-headed. He's a lot like his dad in his forcefulness. When I was in Scotland reporting on the big Trump controversy over there related to a development, it was Donald Jr. who was sent over again and again to act as a troubleshooter. So he's kind of a tough-minded, practical guy who likes to get things done.
So some may hear this and say, good, he's a family man. It speaks highly of him that he cares so much about his family and respects their opinions. Others may look at this and say, well, this could be a problem if he really trusts the members of his immediate family more than anybody else. It's going to be too insular and maybe not a diversity of opinions about what should happen in the campaign or, for that matter, the country.
I think that is a real problem. I think there is a bubble there, and that Trump Tower is actually a rather isolating place. It's in the middle of Manhattan and the most diverse city perhaps in the world. But when you go there, you do get the sense that you're almost in a bunker. And I think there is a risk here that Donald only relies on blood relatives. And one in-law in Jared Kushner and may not have the diversity of opinion he should be hearing. Now, to their credit, I can see that the kids are having a positive influence on Donald's style. You know, he's going to become somewhat presidential finally, and this is something that he's promised for a couple of months but hasn't done, I think, because of Corey Lewandowski. And I think ultimately you're right that the problem of isolation there is a serious one and could be very damaging over the long term, because they're just not going to get the inputs that they need.
Michael D'Antonio, as you've watched what's happened in the last week or so with the firing of Corey Lewandowski, some polls that have come out that have not been as favorable to Donald Trump, where Hillary Clinton is well ahead of him in general election polls. What do you think? Are they very concerned about what's happening with the campaign, the Trump campaign, do you feel?
I think they are. I think all of these moves indicate that there's, if not panic, really profound concern that they're losing control of this. And the thing that Donald fears the most is being embarrassed and humiliated. You know, that's why he talks so much about how they're laughing at us all over the world, is because Donald really cares about whether people laugh at him. And if he is absolutely clobbered by Hillary Clinton, it's going to be very, very difficult for him to recover emotionally from it. So I imagine his kids are actually very concerned just about his well-being going forward.
That's Michael D'Antonio, a former Newsday reporter and the author of The Truth About Trump. Michael, thanks again.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.